Crowpot contains language and themes which may not be suitable for anyone, but what is suitable for everybody is the great stuff from our friends at The Famous, iconic wear for bears. Go check out thefamousheadwear.co.uk. Great stuff over there. And if you want to win some stuff from them, scroll down, hit the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes on this episode that you're listening to right now. We give away stuff from them every single month here on the Crowpot. So check them out, thefamousheadwear.co.uk.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, welcome to the Heart and Hand Crowpod Shades Sagas, I guess is what we're going to go with the podcast. We're going to kick it off this week. Me and David. Hello, David.
Hello. Hello,
are going to talk about presidents who got shot and then died of being shot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a you know, a nice light topic to really kick off the new expanded.
And it's also an important distinction because there are presidents who got shot and didn't die of being shot.
Correct.
And yes. we're not including them. I won't be on this every weekend, incidentally, folks. It's not just like Crowpod Extra. This is a proper show that Shane's doing, but he just asked me on the first time because you know, he knew I'd be available really more than anything. Yeah. Plus, in all fairness, he knows this is very much in my wheelhouse. This is
in your sights.
Yeah. In my ear. Like, right, yeah. But yes, the national pastime of the US, of course, as we know, over the years, pressing to get the shooting presidents included in the Olympics, but it wasn't allowed because the Olympics, you've got to preserve your amateur status, whereas you guys were the pros when it came to having a pot shot at the press. But we've only had the one assassination in the UK.
It's a personal.
Yeah, just the one all those years ago. But no, there's been a lot of assassination attempts in the US, but you've calmed down about the last one, what, 1981? So
The last real one, the one that won it, you know, because kind of ever since then, they tend to suss them out before they get too well developed. So,
yeah. Well, I watched the film In the Line of Fire in preparation for this.
A historical documentary, by the way.
Absolutely, yes. well, it's got the guy from being John Malkovich in it. What's his name again? Oh, yeah, that's right, John Malkovich. he was in it, and no. But, I think it was always one of the more interesting aspects of, and I suppose it ties into that, I know people might kind of lazily say, gun culture and stuff, but it was more about that very much direct, very direct influence on things that American politics has always had, that outlaw element to it. You know, it comes from, you know, a nation state that was formed in pretty tough circumstances. It was formed out of a war. It was formed then out of taking control of your own destiny, and that may require to do so through violent methods. Now, of course, that's like, you know, comparing going to fight off in a what you might term a just war versus just invading your neighbours, right? I mean, there's different levels to it, of course. But I think that it does come from that culture that America was formed in, very much of you take direct action, you don't sit back. And this is, of course, the logic, the pushing it to its illogical extreme. This is way out in the wild. But it's interesting that there's no really linked motive. We're going to discuss four people here today, and there's not really any linked motivation. I mean, you've got all sorts here. No, you've got
all
politics.
Very unique.
Yeah. You've got politics. You've got hatred. You've got office seeking. You've got fame. You've got wanting to be someone. And one of the interesting ones, of course, that we're not going to discuss, but I always find interesting, was the Reagan one, which does seem like a movie plot, and it's to impress Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Because that this was what this guy had done in his head, and it seems like a movie plot, because it would make a perfectly plausible reason to do that. Certainly, God, how old was Reagan when he was 77, I think, when he got shot, and he recovered within weeks. So it was a remarkable, it was like a Hollywood movie. But four who, I think what we would definitely say, one of whom should have survived.
Yeah, the James Garfield story, I think that the people might enjoy.
Not if they were related to him, they wouldn't.
Oh, God. Yeah, we'll get there. two definitely are gone. Getting shot in the head, you usually don't survive that one. McKinley probably had a chance, maybe, in a slightly different time or just in a different setting, as we'll see. And, of course, Garfield really probably should have lived.
Should have, yeah.
Which his assassin also points out.
We're going to have a lot of fun discussing him. He was most certainly a character, but I take it we're starting with the daddy.
Yeah, so we'll get the big one out the way. The big first, going back there on April 14th, 1865, and John Wilkes Booth climbing into the president's box at Ford Theater to put a bullet in the back of President Lincoln's head. Who, for the rich old crime of thinking, blacks shouldn't be slaves. By and large, and entirely Booth's motivation. And it is one of those things that, the further it goes along, or, it's all part of the lost cause aspect of Civil War revision, that there's always all this other, I don't know, people like to add reasons to why Booth went and killed Lincoln. No, he's a Confederate sympathizer and thought slaves should be a thing and wanted to kill Lincoln.
I think an interesting theory that's been put forward by a number of historians is that you do have to take into account, or maybe it's interesting, you don't have to take into account, because what you said there is true. This is why he did this, right? He was a Confederate sympathiser. The South had lost the war. He was appalled at it. He found himself in Washington. He was a famous actor. He was a famous actor, but his father, I think, was the more famous. He was part of this quite famous acting fight. He was Stephen Baldwin.
Yes.
Yeah, in that group. But he found himself in Washington seeing the celebrations and, a lot of anger. I mean, that's the thing. When war ends, very rarely, I think, do people just go, right, fair enough then, and you go back to... You go back to the kind of status antebellum. I don't think that happens. And he was, very, very angry, and he hatched this plot. I think initially, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, he'd had this plan before the end of the war to kidnap Lincoln.
Yes. I believe that was, during Lincoln's... Lincoln, of course, was assassinated right at the beginning of his second term, just over a month into it. While the war was still being... undertaken. He'd met Lincoln before at Ford's Theater in like 1863, and so they decided to come up with this whole kidnapping plan. Of course, with all the people who went about with the plan on the day of Lincoln's assassination, because he wasn't the only one that was supposed to die.
We'll come to it. The plan, I think, was to spirit him to the south and basically hold him hostage against the surrender, wasn't it? Coming out of the south, something like that. So, one of the theories that I've read that's been put forward is that he was an actor, obviously, and therefore the dramatic gesture and maybe even the doomed romantic gesture to him. I mean, it's not a very romantic thing, obviously, murder, but that was a big inspiration to him, that there was this element of somebody who needed attention, you know, and all actors do, that's why they do it. Right. They need, the, especially stage actors, which obviously he was at that time, they need that approbation, they need that thrill, because he did very much think, I will be a hero, you know, I will, you know, I'll go to the South, I'll escape to the South and be feted and be, I'll be the man who killed Lincoln. So I think that idea of, I'll be forever admired for what I've done. It's amazing how many assassins think that they'll be forever admired, and then they kill someone and people say, well, actually, you're a murderer. And it doesn't work like that.
Slips away.
I think it is the case with him. But,
I think part of the thing with Booth, too, is, you know, the longer this went on, was, you know, it was over 2 years from the conception of the kidnapping plan, to him finally pulling the trigger. Like, you start to see in some of his writings, you know, to his mother or to his friends, or I think it was Lewis Powell that attended Lincoln's speech with him at the White House just a few days before the assassination. And this is one where Lincoln was promoting, you know, that blacks, once they were free, be given voting rights, which Booth, of course, did not like. But he didn't have a gun on him, so he kept trying to egg Lewis Powell on to shoot him right there. And either Powell wouldn't or couldn't, you know, nobody really knows. But, I mean, by the end, it had become this completely consuming fascination of his. You know, even to the point where the night in which they finally go to execute their plan, the other people are kind of like, I don't know if this is a good idea now, man. Like, war's over. You know, Lee's down there surrendering. I don't know what we got to gain with this one. And he's still like, nah, fuck this, I'm doing it.
Yeah, and that definitely, I think, plays into the kind of the doomed cause and the whole... Because, I mean, one of the things about the South almost immediately was to try and, if you like, they tried to recast what the war had been. As somebody said, right, we can't win the war, but we can win the peace. And what they immediately tried to do was recast it as somehow that they'd been the victim, that somehow it was this romanticized, doomed struggle for existence and whatnot. And I think that this is an early sign of that, very early, of course, you know, mm-hmm. It's the immediate aftermath of the war, and that it plays into that. But you're right. I mean, it was a fairly wide-reaching plan. I mean, it wasn't just that sometimes gets lost in. I mean, this was, they were trying to kill the cabinet.
Yeah. Well, it was, yeah, because what, Powell was supposed to go get, I think it was William Seward, who was the Secretary of State. And, of course, they wanted, was it Axelrod, I think, was one of the other accomplices. He was supposed to go kill Andrew Johnson, which really would have worked out better for all of us if that happened. He chickened
Although out. Yeah, I don't blame him, though, because Johnson was a fucking terrifying man. No matter
and a vicious drunk, too. I mean, he would have been pissed up. Just
He'd have strung him up. I mean, there's a great story about Johnson, which is true, incidentally, that he because he was clearly, you know, the one unionist senator in the South, he was going to give a speech before the war. And he was told, you know, if you turn up at this, there are people saying they're going to kill you. And he walked onto the lectern, put his gun out and said, I've been told that there are people in the audience tonight who wish to cause me harm. Is this correct? And nobody moves. He says, right, OK, I've been misinformed. And delivers his speech while holding his gun for the whole of the time he was up there. So, you know, he was a fairly bad bastard. But, you know, they attacked other cabinet members. One was stabbed mm-hmm. very badly. During this, so the plan was to cause chaos, and you know, obviously assassinating the president was going to do that anyway, but it was to put the North really into political paralysis. The idea was, well, they won't be able to function. The story itself, I think, is again, it contains elements of, you know, obviously tragedy, but there's comedy in there as well, because famously Booth jumps. For those of you who might not be too familiar with the story, Booth was well known at the theatre. He was an actor. So that's why he kind of had free rein to wander about in it. And he walks into Lincoln's box, shoots him from behind. But then And this is the bit that is darkly comic, I think, Shane. Tries to leap from the stage to, or leap from the box to the stage, shouting, what was it, Six Emperor Tyrannus?
Yeah, it depends on who. Yeah, there's it was either Death to Tyrants or The South Rises Again, or, you know, there's like 20 different, but basically, yeah, I just killed the son of a bitch.
That's the gist of it. But yeah. He's Spark, because obviously, you know, he'd ridden a horse. His Spark catches on some grape.
Bunting, I guess.
Bunting, yeah. That was hanging up. You know, you see it in theaters still to this day. You know, they'll have banners and stuff up. And it catches on that, and he lands on the stage and breaks his leg, which was to play a part in the execution of poor old Dr. Samuel Mudd later on.
Yeah. More people are dying. You know, the thing, too, of course, this is before Secret Service protection. Lincoln did have some bodyguards. There have been at least two attempts on his life prior, right? There was the Baltimore plot, literally while he's on his way to Washington, D.C. And then there was another incident in which they'd found a bullet hole had pierced through his top hat. So, I mean, this wasn't the first go. But his guards, it come up to the intermission. They went to the pub across the street and were drinking while this was going on. So
I think that's probably the most staggering thing to modern observers, because you've just come off a civil war. So it's not even like, you know, the front
five days earlier.
It's not like you've come off the front is 1,000 miles away, and as if they would have left FDR, you know, just sitting in a public space on his own without anybody guarding him. But
they had to prop him up. I mean, that's the difference. Well,
true, but at that time they genuinely did believe that, yeah, it's okay, you know, it's a perfectly normal thing. But the other thing about that I find staggering that we'll come to with the next, that this didn't really prompt a massive change in the security of a president. It didn't cause that. And you're really looking to when certainly a fair old chunk into the 20th century before we begin to see what we might consider to be.
They had to kill the fourth one.
Yeah, exactly, before we get to the stage where, and it is difficult because it's one man, and one man who does occasionally have to be out in public, and it you know, who is a politician who has to go in glad hand. Tell you what, if I was a second term president, would I ever be walking the crowd? You know, you don't need that. They're never going to vote for you ever again.
Also a lesson that doesn't get learned in these four stories.
No, exactly. Just stay in at that point and during your second term. But Booth escapes, rides off, and then an enormous manhunt. And I think that this is, you and I will sit and have a laugh about the US throughout history at times. We'll have a laugh about the UK on the Crow Pod, but you know, when America puts its resources into something, then you are fucked if you're the person on the end of it. And they eventually track him down to a bar, to a bar.
He stopped at a few bars along the way, but yes.
Well, the Samuel Mudd thing, for people who might not know, he was a doctor and they woke him up, broken ankle and everything, and he treated him. Yep. And you bastards hung him.
Yeah. Yeah. No idea. They were like, oh, we've got the famous doctor, or the famous actor, Mr. Booth here, but he's got an injured ankle. Oh no, I'll take care of him. Yeah. Oh wait. You didn't tell me the part about him shooting the president right before you came here.
And even if you had, it's his hippopotamus oath. he you know, that's that a doctor has to treat, so they're not allowed. I mean, that's part of that. You treat a sick person, you treat an injured person. You don't get to make moral decisions, but he was tried and he was hung for his part in it. The other controversial one was the Mary Atterot, who was the woman who ran the boarding house he stayed at, and she was hung. And that was considered quite controversial because she was a female. She was hung for being involved in the plot. And that one's, I think, probably been the one that's engendered the most debate afterwards throughout history about whether or not there was enough evidence linking her to it. But they didn't mess about in terms of the trials. They were basically military court-martials, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, effectively at that point. Well, I think they treated them as, you know, what we would now call enemy combatants, you know, still trying to execute, well, what was considered and is considered, you know, legal war. So, yeah, they didn't really fuck around.
Which is
and the rewards went out, you know, right away and everything. And, of course, you know, Booth is finally found, as we said, in a barn in Virginia. I think it was 12 days later, and it was soldiers from, I want to say the 16th New York Cavalry who were just gotten done fighting a civil war against these fucking Southerners, and now they're sent to go find this one who just shot the president. So he's hiding in the barn.
They weren't in the best of moods.
No. So he's hiding in the barn. They set the barn on fire, and Booth's sitting there, you know, giving, "I won't be taken alive," which is true. Because I believe it was Boston Corbett, who was a sergeant, crept up behind the barn and just shot him in the back of the head. So, yeah, and he was still alive. They weren't done.
They set fire to the barn.
Yeah.
And then, standard tactics, yeah. To be fair.
Yeah. No, but the... yes.
Yeah, that... the one of the most long... you know, probably the of all these assassinations, and I can hear Kennedy files getting upset at me, but this was the one that without a doubt had the most long-term effect because of what Shane referred to back then, which was the person who then took over. In that wonderful way that you guys have managed to get yourselves into this fankle, I think, four times previously, where the party who'd won the election then have to put a president in who isn't a member of their party, which is quite a good trick, incidentally. Mm-hmm. But you've managed it more than once. Andrew Johnson, who is a Democrat, becomes the president. He'd been put on as part of a kind of unity ticket to during the previous election.
Which was a common... The split tickets were a lot more common back then than they obviously...
They were. Especially the parties hadn't... I mean, the Republican Party's brand new at this point, really. Yeah. It's less than a decade old. Then before that, you had the Whigs, which was less a party, more a kind of coalition, really, wasn't it? Just of various interests. But Johnson comes in, and of course it's him who delivers Reconstruction, and that would have significant effects for the next, well, till now, really. But particularly for the next century alone. And that's why, with all due respect to the other three, yes, including Kennedy, that I'd say that this assassination was by far the most influential and the most long-reaching consequences. Although it did, you know, Lincoln hadn't been this saint when he was alive.
No.
But almost immediately on death, he was almost sort of canonized.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, the war had just ended. So, I mean, there wasn't really time to consider, you know, the impact and everything that had gone on. And then, of course, when you're replaced by a absolute fucking sack of cum like Andrew Johnson, it makes people realize how good they had it. Up until the point somebody put a bullet in your head. So.
But, you know, you go for another 20 years without one. So that wasn't bad.
Not quite, right?
Not quite. Not didn't make the full.
No. About 16 years here.
And isn't there an interesting story about Abraham Lincoln's son being...
Yeah.
Ah, right. Go on.
Yeah. So we got a lot of ties in here. So now I want you guys to remember this name because it's going to come up here in a little bit. Dr. Willard Bliss. Okay.
Right.
Dr. Willard Bliss. We're going to come back to him. Now, he was in the treatment of Lincoln, though he was not the head doctor. No, that was, of course, Charles Leal. But Bliss did take kindly to, you know, going and talking to the press and trying to build up, you know, he'd be like the fake TV doctors of the 1860s, basically. And quite literally a snake oil salesman. I believe the American Medical Association at one point held him up on charges of quackery. So keep this man in mind as we move along to the horrible, awful death of James Garfield, who only made it 200 days in office.
Didn't even want to be president.
No, not at all. No. 200 days, you know, as David just said there, coming off the back of Grant's two terms. And, of course, at the time, while not written in law, there was still the practice of a president not serving more than two terms because Washington had done so. So there were some Republicans that still wanted to put Grant back in. That, of course, met some resistance, some because of the two-term hang-up, some because people were just getting sick of Grant. Not that Grant was by any means a bad, you know, one of the worst presidents, but he had enough scandals throughout his time there, and his health was starting to fail as a matter of course. So Garfield,
it wasn't so much him as, I mean, I don't think anyone's ever accused him of being personally corrupt, but certainly his cabinet
everyone
was full of wrongings.
Him.
Yeah, I mean, they made out like bandits. Really, you know, think Charles Green. If it wasn't nailed down, then Grant's cabinet were away with it. And he was, you know, quite upstandingly moral. In fact, I think we lost a lot of money actually being shysters through bad investments. But his problem was he picked bad friends and then was too loyal to them.
Yeah. So we get to the Republican convention here. Garfield's there because Garfield had recently been selected. He'd been in the Ohio contingent of the U.S. House of Representatives, right? Served well, and prior to this, Garfield and Polk, I think, are the two guys who ended up being president that never, ever really wanted to be president. Now, we didn't get to see what Garfield could do. Polk, of course, famously just told him, like, look, I'll do it for 4 years, and I'm fucking done. Don't ask me to run again. This is it.
Killed him. They worked so hard, they killed himself.
Yeah, pretty much. Garfield, by all means, a good member of the House of Representatives. I think he was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee for a while, the effective minority leader at one point before that became a term, and was about to move into the U.S. Senate when it comes up to the presidential nomination time in 1880. And so they're sitting there, and these people are trying to, you know, they don't want Grant, they don't want to, trying to figure this thing out. And then all of a sudden, I think it was a group out of Wisconsin, just throws their votes behind Garfield, who's like, what the fuck? I'm not running. Nor have I ever said for a second that I want to run. So, of course, everybody does the reasonable thing and continues to build more votes for James Garfield until he finally overcomes Grant on, you know, took a number of ballots. And so begrudgingly, he says, okay, all right, I'll do it. And then wins an election that he doesn't want to win, narrowly over Winfield Hancock. All this time, there's a guy named Charles Guiteau, who's kind of just a fringe local political, I don't know, consultant, I think is what we would call him these days.
But, volunteer might be more accurate.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that might be even better. So he'd written a speech for Garfield. Well, actually, he'd written it for Grant, and then Garfield won the nomination. So he changed all the references from Grant to Garfield. So it didn't make any fucking sense. Obviously, Garfield never gives a speech, but Guiteau, who maybe has a little bit of the Hinckley to him, let's say.
Definitely.
Yeah. Starts to think he should be awarded a ambassadorship, preferably to Paris.
one of the best. Well, one of the two best ones, or the two biggest ones, certainly at the time, Paris or London, and he's after Paris. I think that this culture that we, again, maybe don't quite understand, because it's never been quite as naked over here. I mean, it existed, but the whole spoil system in the US post Andrew Jackson, where he said, you know, when I win the election, the jobs that we control, well-paid, easy jobs, we are going to give to our supporters. Yeah. And that became, you know, the spoil system. And ever since then, it was fairly open in fact, not fairly, it was totally open. The political party who wanted in got in, and then if you, you know, worked for them or you were their supporter, you would go and get these jobs. And genuinely, this is stunning to me. I know it's the 19th century, but people could go, just go to the White House and ask for a job, and they would take you in to see the president, and you would sit and you would say, hi, you know, I worked on the campaign, I did this, you know, I'm do that, I'm, yeah, I run a newspaper and I'm the editor and I've been pro you. And if, you know, that they found that you'd done enough, then yeah, you'd be given a job. Now, again, you know, we don't want to make it sound like every job that was given out, you know, they didn't make you chief breast oiler at Playboy or anything. You know, it could be as simple as, right, you know, we'll put you on the tax collecting committee for this, or you'll go on to, I suppose the modern thing would be these sort of quangos that governments, you know, have. Yeah. But, you know, well-paid position in a time when, you know, the job market certainly wasn't like it is now, but it was well-paid, there wasn't a lot of work in it. It was a reward, and people understood this. But this chap hadn't really worked on the campaign. I mean, he was a supporter of them, but... Yeah. You know, bar some leafleting, genuinely some leafleeting. Hadn't really
Which he
done
didn't
much.
Pay for.
No, exactly.
He didn't pay the bill for.
He didn't pay the bill for it. It goes to the party. And the thing that makes this so, of course, really interesting is the whole stalwart thing, because the Garfield was, you know, people were sick of this system where what they called machine politics, where people genuinely would... you know, New York had a really big one called Tammany Hall, and what that would mean, it was almost like what we might think of unions, you know, the whole Jimmy Hoffa idea of a union, that you signed up to the party, you promised them your vote, and they would therefore go in and they would look after you, basically, you know, they would then make sure that your district got, you know, the best cleaning and got the new buildings and all that sort of stuff, and that's how it worked. But people were sick of it. The progressive movement came along and said, no, our politics are dirty. We've got it. And Garfield was one of them. Unfortunately, his vice president was representative of a group called the Stalwarts, a guy called Chester E. Arthur. And you've just got over your Chester E. arthritis. So this guy, this Guiteau, he was a stalwart, he said. He supported the Stalwarts. He supported the principle. And people openly did, Shane. Again, that's the other thing that I think that I find staggering, is people would openly say, no, I support this system of giving out the good jobs to my pals. You know, can you imagine that now? It happens, but at least they have the fucking good grace not to say.
Yeah. It's just a blatantly, you know, brazen. Well, and Guiteau here, like, you know, the day after Garfield's inauguration, he shows up in D.C. thinking that he's still going to be able to get a gig, right? Goes to see Garfield at the White House on March 8th and drops off a copy of the speech, which, again, it wasn't even about Garfield in the first place. It was all about Grant, and he just changed, literally just crossed out Grant and wrote Garfield. So he keeps hounding on, and it was James Blaine, who's the Secretary of State, who finally, sometime in May, is just like, man, get the fuck out of here, right? Like, we're not giving you a job. Don't know who the fuck you are. Get the fuck out. Now, of course, is anybody taking the time to look before, you know, of course, this is before Google, you know, there's no internet, which again will become a problem when we get to Dr. Bliss. Guiteau had been, I don't know if he was committed in the mid 1870s, but his family had been like, this guy's insane. Somebody's got to do something. And then he took off, you know. So now this is obviously coming back up here 6 years later in the presence of the president. Guiteau goes and buys a British Bulldog revolver and follows the president to a police station, a train station, the Baltimore and Potomac Railroad Station, where, again, Garfield is what, David? What is he doing?
He's on his own. He's going for a short holiday. And this is true, people. The President of the United States in the 19th century, we are not talking mud huts era here, right? In the 19th century, leaves the White House, goes out the front door with his luggage, gets into a taxi, right? It's a stagecoach, but it's a taxi. rides to the train station and gets out, just like you or I would do going on holiday. And he's walking up the stairs into the train station on his own, or with you know, one aide who's just keeping him company on the trip, but that's it.
Yep. And get shot. So here's what we've got now. Now Garfield's been in office for I'll do this math here. 121 days at this point, I want to say. Just over 4 months, right? That sounds right. Garfield makes it in office 200 days. So he's been in office for 121, he makes it 200, which tells you he survives now nearly 80 days after being shot. And by all accounts here, God, he probably would have just made it had it not been for the doctor that they called, who was, again,
the aforementioned
Dr. Willard Bliss. Now, I will point out, his name is actually Dr. Willard Bliss, which I think at some point in this man's life, something happened and they went, is there a doctor in the house? And he went, yes, my name is Dr. Yes, I'm here. Yes. I'm right here. And this, that's how he became a doctor.
It's so good right from the get-go. First of all, the president is lying bleeding in the station. And he does that thing that great men do, and the next president will do this as well, where they immediately say, the Tsar who was murdered said this, Archduke Franz Ferdinand said this, don't hurt him, don't hurt the assassin.
Yeah.
If somebody shoots me and I'm lucid, I'm saying, fucking kill him. Right, I'll tell you that right now. Tear him limb from limb. But the great men in history tend not to. So immediately, doctors come in from all, you know, the news gets about the local area, and doctors rush down there. They carry him. They lift him, right, bleeding, shot. And they carry him up the stairs into a small room in the train station where they have found a dirty old mattress, which they lay him on. With his wounds exposed to it, several of the doctors then start to try and remove the bullet by poking about in the hole with their hands, which they haven't washed. Can you see the problem here?
And we will point out, too, also, Dr. Willard Bliss, even at that time, again, charged with the AMA with quackery at one point, was, like, well known to be exceptionally dirty. But there's first person accounts from the time of, you know, like his coat was just constantly covered in blood. He never washed his hands. Garfield has been hit twice. The first bullet grazes his shoulder. The second one, as David said, it's opened up. He got shot in the back, right? And it fucked up a vertebrae, which is why, you know, he goes down. Obviously, getting shot, not great. Bliss and his team.
It would knock me down.
No. Oh, and Bliss also was called because Robert Todd Lincoln happened to be there. And, of course, because I believe he was secretary of something. Was he secretary of war for Garfield?
Lincoln's son.
Yes. Goes, you know what? I know a doctor. This guy who was there when my dad, who died while they kept shoving things inside of his head. He was there. We should call him. So Bliss does, like, fist fucks Garfield to the point where he opens up multiple. They couldn't find the bullet wound track after all of this, right?
No.
And this is going on for more than 2 months while Garfield's awake and conscious.
Lucid and writing letters. He was dealing with some state stuff. He wrote to his mother and said that he was feeling better. He was going to recover. He should have recovered. They weren't fatal wounds. But. The treatment he receives is, at one point, they bring in leeches.
Oh, yeah.
It's the 19th century. And look, I would sort of hope if I was the president, I could get the best doctors. You know, they call me old-fashioned if you were. George Washington would have got better doctors than this.
Yeah.
And that's a century earlier. But he catches what you guys would call staff, what we would call MRSA or MRSA. Set to see, you know, whatever you want to call it, and he dies 80 days later. Now, go on.
Not before. So he starts losing. Garfield was a hefty man for the time. He's about 220 pounds. He loses about 80, 90 pounds during this. Bliss, all right, again, quackery. decides to start shoving the food up his ass, right? Makes this thing of beef broth and blood and ground beef and starts pumping it up the president's ass with a hand pump, trying to put nutrients into it. Now, we know, even at this point, you can't really give nutrients to a body by shoving it up the ass, except for in, you know, like some rare occasions where you have to. This, of course, responds in Garfield laying here now on a table, violently exploding diarrhea of this back out his ass, because it has to come back out all over this room that I presume is like, you know, I can't remember if this is at the tea house or if they had him back. I think they had him back to the White House by this point. But there's got to be a room where they're like, yeah, this is the Garfield room. Like, that just
don't go in there. just you want to avoid it. The really, you know, the interesting thing is that when he shot him, he announces he's been arrested. I am a stalwart and I'm proud to have done this because now Chet Arthur will be president. So Chet Arthur becomes a bloody unpopular fellow immediately, as people not unreasonably jump to the conclusion you put him up to this, right? So he spends this 80 days, because Chet Arthur was a lazy, lazy man. He's my type of politician. He was in it for as much money as he could get, right? He had a very lavish lifestyle. He dressed well. He was the head, I think, of the Port Authority in New York, which, as you can imagine, the amount of stuff that was coming into the port, you could skim. Has anyone seen season two of The Wire? Right, you could skim, okay? And it was a great post to have. He didn't get into politics because he had any idealistic expectations. He was one of Roscoe Conkling, a legendary machine politician. By the way, Roscoe Conkling is a name. I would vote for a guy called Roscoe Conkling. That's magnificent.
I'm looking for us to snatch him up on a free transfer, right?
That's how you start. And Roscoe Conkling, super. We need more Roscoes doing the business. But Arthur was not idealistic. He's not high-minded. He wasn't in it to change things. He was in it for the money, right? Fairly open about it as well. He gets added to the vice presidential list. Again, party unity between the two groups, the progressives and the stalwarts. And he spends 80 days at the president's bedside, basically saying, please don't die, 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 please don't die. After he does die and he becomes the president, with a lot of anger, you know, people saying, okay, right, you maybe didn't put him up to it, but still he must be happy about it, not really realizing he didn't want to be the president, he kind of goes over a new leaf. And he's not a good president, but nor is he a bad one. And he does see through some legislation that changes the spoil system, more out of guilt, I think, than anything else. But again, just somebody who did not want to be the president, but was put in this position because the assassin literally shouts in front of witnesses and says that his interrogations, no, I did it so that he would be the president, despite the fact that he was like, I don't want to be the frigging president. I don't know what this guy is. There's a throw mama from the train vibe here, I think.
So Gateau ends up going on trial, right? Represented by his brother-in-law. Now, again, he's crazy. I mean, we can't really skirt past.
No, he is.
The guy's fucking nuts.
And we're not talking about he's mad, you know, oh, he's mad that he's a character or he was about out there. He was genuinely insane. Although brilliantly, he was ruled not to be insane so they could hang him.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, justice looks more like, I don't know, vengeance, I guess. But during the trial, right, Gateau, like, he gives his testimony in like the form of poetry, equating to like Ulysses. He passes notes to people out in the crowd seeking legal advice. He gets up and sings. He gets up and sings John Brown's Body at one point. He tries to kill himself a couple times. And then at the end of all this, like, in his defense, I'm not, you know, once they decide now we're going to put him on trial, he's not crazy, even though he obviously is. He's like, well, you know what? I didn't kill the motherfucker. That doctor did.
That doctor did. And to be fair, that was the most lucid thing he said. Yeah, he's, you know, he would have survived it. And it's a fair old point. But no, this is a president who should have survived, who I think was actually a very good man and would have made a very good politician. But ironically, the thing he most wanted, which was political reform, the way that campaigns were done, the way that it was this great big money-making scheme, actually gets put through because of his death, which is, you know, unfortunate. But the thing he wanted most did happen, but was actually done by his archenemy. Because of his death. So the one positive to come out of it for poor old Garfield and his legacy was that I don't know if he'd have been able to get it through, you know, without this. And obviously that then leads into the kind of progressive era, and you do get, you know, towards Teddy Roosevelt and stuff.
And how do we get Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, there you go, actually, an accidental segue. How did we get to Teddy Roosevelt?
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
So, have we learned lessons? Should the president just be out in crowds? Probably not, right? You know, maybe should we check to see that there aren't crazy people walking around in the room with the president? Possibly. Armed guards? Maybe. Do we do any of this? No. So, William McKinley. So, we've gone 16 years between Lincoln and Garfield. 15 years later, William McKinley, just 6 months into his second term, is at the Pan American Exposition up in beautiful Buffalo, New York, having a time with his wife, who just recovered from a fairly serious illness. Yeah. She'd picked up on a trip to the West. He was actually the first president to ever visit the West Coast, you know, while sitting. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, they return home. They spend a couple months waiting for her to recover. He literally spends like 2 months fixing up the house. I mean, that's pretty much all he does. And he's working on a couple speeches that he's going to give at this exposition. They spend a few days at. They go to Niagara Falls, which, as me and David discussed on a recent Crow Pod, I don't know why, because after you've been there and look at the water, you kind of just want to get the fuck out. And I can't imagine it was any better back in 1901. No, than it is today.
Even you know, they didn't even have the shitty casino then.
Oh, so they come back over to Buffalo on September 6, 1901. McKinley is standing in a room, letting a whole bunch of people walk past him. And famously, he had this technique for like handshaking where he could like swing you right past him. I don't know if he just jerked you and fucking threw you or whatever, but he could rifle through people in the handshake line.
If you've ever been in a line with like a politician, it happened to me years ago with Tony Blair, 1996, before he was prime minister, when he was a Labour leader, he came to do a talk at my university. And it is that, you walk up and you put your hand out and they take your hand, put the other hand on your arm and sort of swing you around as if they're doing a jig, and they're kind of, hey, thanks for coming, great to meet you, brilliant. And you're sort of, how the fuck did that happen? And you've been, you know, you literally, it's like go up, touch, swing, and you're away again. So yeah, it's a politician trick, I think.
Well, there were some estimates McKinley was so good at it that he could see 50 people in less than a minute. So I mean, he's just pumping people through the crowd, right?
Yeah, he's just whoosh, you know, he's batting through it.
Until he gets to a Polish anarchist, David.
Leon Czolgosz, yes. Now, in terms of, you hear the word anarchist, and I think, you know, we live in a post-Sex Pistols world, and anarchy is an overused term. This is the high point of the genuine anarchist movement. And around the world, assassination was the thing, you know. There was obviously the czars in Italy, several of in Italy and Russia were murdered. The Italian king was murdered. Franz Ferdinand would of course be murdered. There was the king and queen of Serbia were brutally murdered. Brutally murdered by the army in a military coup. But it was considered a legitimate tactic of the anarchist group, because the idea was we will cause chaos, there will then be anarchy, and it will be a fairer society. People won't be governed in that way, because again, you know, the term anarchy, we use it to indicate, you know, a breakdown of order, but that's what they wanted, you know. And it wasn't that they wanted the world to be everybody running about fighting, it was just, you know, you would then go back to almost a sort of village commune style of living, was the idea. And it's utopian and it doesn't work. I mean, that's the whole point of it. But again, when we're talking about the security, it was not a time where it was unheard of. You know, one of the great beliefs of anarchist movements all over the world was you kill elected officials, politicians. I say Russia was terrible for it, you know, at the time. Literally, cabinet members and office holders and royalty were targeted constantly, and it happened all around the world. But the you know, this is America, you know, they just thought that people are free, people can do what they like, people, you know, the presidents in this era had a kind of fatalism about them. I mean, they were aware that it could happen, they just didn't seem to take any steps to stop it.
Yeah, no, and that's, you know, we still don't have the Secret Service. I mean, well, the Secret Service does exist, but it's not doing what we think it does now. It's still effectively, like, he's got a couple Pinkertons guarding him, you know.
Yeah.
That's about it.
It's a couple of bodyguards, but it's not this thing that they'll scope out areas for weeks that the president's going to go to and do this. Although the Secret Service did say to him not to do this, not to go and meet.
Don't go specifically to this building.
Yeah, they definitely did say that to him.
Twice, he put it back on the itinerary. So
yeah.
Yeah.
But Leon Czolgosz, who, again, you know, an anarchist politician, wasn't insane. You know, we've just described somebody who was clearly mentally disturbed. He wasn't. He just genuinely did believe. He wasn't, you know, a particularly liked person within the groups, the political groups he moved in. A lot of them felt that he was a spy. You know, a lot of government.
There's a lot of similarities between him and, you know, the guy that we come to last, I think.
Yeah, there is. He's desperate to fit in somewhere, and he goes along to these, you know, or subversive group. These days, we've got a simpler name for them, terrorists. Right? We we now just get to the point. If you want to do something like that, you're a terrorist. But back then, there were all sorts of different political names.
Well, actually, we call them freedom fighters here. I think you'll find.
Yeah, Duck Dynasty candidates. But they didn't really take to him. He was a bit of an oddball, funnily enough. Again, he thinks, well, what can I do? What can I do that will persuade them, you know, that I'm not an informer, that I'm not someone that they can trust me, and comes up with this, you know, outlandish plan to kill the president. But it's not outlandish because he can do it, and he gets a gun, conceals it in a handkerchief, and shoots twice at McKinley. And again, McKinley does that thing I hate of going, "Don't hurt him."
Yeah.
It is me.
Yeah. Oh, and they were definitely going to kill him.
They were going to kill him. He would have died there and then had he not intervened, which again, I think, is a measure of the man, in all honesty, that he did that. And McKinley was a good president. You know, he'd had the war with Spain, which wasn't, he fought that war, not in that sense. He fought going to war as much as he possibly could. But when you've got a Congress who wants it, a country who wants it, it is going to be an easy war. There's not going to be any real comeback from it. It was very hard to eventually fight off. But he'd grown up, I think, in the Civil War, hadn't he? And he had a real fear. He'd served as a medical.
Yeah. He'd seen it. So.
He knew, war is not glamorous. It's not all the shit that they talk. And I wish that had been a lesson that had been learned in Europe, where, of course, the elected heads of Europe thought war was this lovely, glamorous, short thing. And that.
Yeah, but when you don't go.
Exactly. No, but also, you know, they thought it was this idea of you know, there would be guys on horses, you know, with a wet. They had this idea, and you have a big bat. It's a conscript volunteer. It's a volunteer army, well trained. And what you do is your army goes up against their army in a field somewhere, and it's done in a day. And somebody wins and somebody loses, and that was it, right? That's not war, and it wasn't, certainly wasn't by this stage of the game. You know, we've got machine guns and whatnot. Of course, Europe doesn't learn this lesson that McKinley already knew, and you get the Great War, you get World War One, you get this slaughter and industrial that scars the whole continent for the whole world, really, for the whole century.
Well, so, and then we don't learn from that one either. We got to try it one more time.
To be fair, the first one wasn't, you know, the first one was everybody's fault. The second one, there was there was a couple of countries in particular. I thought, you know, I will sort of say Germany and Japan deserve a lot of the responsibility for that one. You know, that one's sort of on them. But again, you know, that is, you know, being flippant, because there's, you know, Versailles and various other reasons that they grew up, the collapse of empires and nothing filling them, and then right wing and left wing authoritarian governments sprout up. But yeah, he was a good man, and the really interesting thing, of course, unfortunately for poor McKinley, is most people who get followed by the vice president, then generally the vice president has been selected for, you know, various reasons, and not always for the best ones. This guy who's been selected, he's been put in the vice presidency to stop him doing anything, because he's been, you know, the party, he's a loose cannon, he's a head case, you know. He's a wild man, literally, you know.
He's out in the woods. You know, so McKinley gets shot, obviously, and the same again. I mean, it's not the word, but it is a gut shot, and it is 1901. But they get through with the operation and all this stuff. And ironically, just like with Garfield, where not only was there an X-ray machine in D.C. available, but Graham Bell brought his induction, whatever he called it, the thing that could have easily found the bullet, if not for Dr. Bliss ramming his fist into his body over and over and over again.
He's back again, folks.
So, no X-ray machines, though, right, for McKinley. They didn't want to scare him, even though they had two at the scene of the fair. So they get in there, they again reach around, just digging in there, can't find the bullet, stitch him up. And they start briefing people that he's okay. So Teddy Roosevelt's like, fuck it, I'm going to go up to the Adirondacks and do my Teddy Roosevelt shit. Not good, because, you know, when a bullet pierces your stomach and then your colon and everything else, there tends to be some stuff that leaks out that maybe you don't want just floating around in your body.
No.
And McKinley starts to, fall back apart here. Now, at first, they say the pain in his abdomen is just indigestion, and so give him, like, some milk and Maalox or whatever. You're fine. You're fine. No, that's the sepsis sitting in throughout his entire abdomen, which is apparently now just filled with pus. And he dies 8 days later. Now, think not 80, 8. So a little bit better time frame than Garfield.
Yeah, it's, again, so bizarre, because it's in that era where, you know, you're on the cusp, really. And there had been medical advances. It should not have happened. He should have survived. But again, panic just sets in whenever a president gets shot in these two examples, and people make bad decisions at the time when you really need people to be making good decisions. And that, you know, that's the key, that you really need people to be doing stuff that will save you, not stuff that will kill you. And neither of these guys get that, and it's a real shame for McKinley, because I think that, you know, history would have been more, he would have been more remembered. I think if he'd finished his term, he would have been considered a pretty decent president. He is considered a pretty decent president, but he's then followed by a guy who literally revolutionizes the office of the president. I mean, he does. He's followed by this hurricane of a human in Theodore Roosevelt, a man who just, you know, there were no such thing as boundaries, and this incredible energy and whatnot. To put it into context, Teddy Roosevelt later is on his way to deliver a speech when he's campaigning for election, and he's shot, but he's saved in a way by, he has a 50 page speech in his breast pocket, which takes some of the effect off the bullet, but the bullet goes into him, and he then goes and delivers an hour and a half speech
Yep.
While bleeding, and then says at the end, "I'm sorry, folks. I had intended to speak for longer. However, I am somewhat shot." What a fucking brilliant line! "I am somewhat shot," and then he goes off and gets patched up. What a magnificent human being he was.
Well, see, now David's brought that up. Finally, after this, right? Not after Lincoln, not after Garfield, not after McKinley, but after the assassination attempt on Roosevelt, just about a year into him taking over from McKinley, is finally when they put the Secret Service, that's still at that point part of the Treasury Department, in charge of protecting the president. They still don't get this all the way done, though. It takes, I think it was 1906 or 1907, because there were members of Congress that, again, kind of as a spoilage effort, wanted the army in charge of protecting the president. But they finally get this done. The Secret Service is now there. We have full-time security after we've only let three presidents be murdered and Roosevelt take a bullet less than a year after the last guy. Everything's good, right? You know, we go through the war. Roosevelt's fine. Truman, some guys tried to shoot him, but they tried to do it from, like, outside the house, you know, so whatever. So you get a couple. Then we get to the big one. And I think it is the big one, you know, as you said, the impacts of Lincoln's are far further. But everybody saw this one. And that, of course, makes its impact on the psyche and society as a whole, I think, far greater than the other three.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, it's JFK moment. It's yep. given itself to a name. And I think that everything he became in death as well. And then the way that the 60s go.
We're not done killing people with the president in the 60s.
No, the political upheavals that happened, you know, it does almost launch this, as you say, incredible era of violence and assassinations and murders and whatnot and riots. And you know, we've all, it's become a cliche, but, you know, the images of 60s riots while Summer in the City by the Loving Spoonful plays. Yeah. You know, that it's become a cliche, but it's all along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, and there's, you know, Vietnam footage put in. But it's true, and it's something that even, you know, me growing up in the 80s as a small boy, in Ayrshire, you know, 1,000 miles away, more than, I was going to say literally, but literally a lot more, but, you know, nowhere near it, not affect my life, and it was something you were aware of. You know, you were aware President Kennedy got killed in Dallas in 1963, and it's something that, to this day, you know, one of the books about the assassination, Not in My Lifetime, when asked about whether or not, you know, people would ever really know the truth, because it asks questions about you know, power, about who runs the world, about what goes on, what we know as the public, all of that. And it is, of course, and will forever be the biggest and greatest conspiracy theory in the world. And I know people will say 9/11, and I know people will say, you know, World War II, that, you know, did Roosevelt know any of that? There's 1,000 conspiracy theories. Roswell, none of them. Yeah. Have captured the public imagination and held the public imagination in the way that the Kennedy one does.
Yeah, I mean, 60 years on now.
Yeah. And it's showing no signs of abating. If somebody brings out a Kennedy movie next year, it would be a hit. It doesn't show signs. There are Kennedy books come out, you know, every year. Kennedy assassinated specifically, not biographies. You know, there are biographies come out every year, but it has a hold on the popular imagination, I think, personally, more than any other. And I think that if you ever wanted to demonstrate conspiracy theories to someone, this is your textbook, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, let's, before we fully climb down that rabbit hole, there is another lesson here, because we're not done with the president's protection detail just yet. There was an incident that no one knew about, and I'm kind of interested if you did, because this only came to surface about 2.5 years ago. But on October 19th, 1962, during the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy was on tour. He was here in Illinois in Springfield. And just like what happened in Dallas that day, of course, you know, the plan of the motorcade was given to the press before. It's on the front page of the paper. It's on this, on that. And at one point during this, there was a rifle seen pointing out of a window with a scope on it overlooking the president's motorcade. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Secret Service arrested two men aged 16 and 20 who for some reason came up with the story that, well, we just wanted to see if we could, if we use a scope going through, if we could get a better view of him coming back without it. Like, I, you know, what? But
President John F. Kennedy, a motorcade, a rifle seen from a building above. It's not Dallas, 1963. We're talking Springfield a year earlier. JFK made a visit to the Illinois capital city, and for the most part, it went off as planned. But new information has recently come to light about an incident involving two young men and a rifle. What happened back then? We turn to reporter Crystal Thomas with the Springfield newspaper, the State Journal Register, whose article ran this week. Crystal, thanks for being with us, and let's start by explaining Kennedy's visit to Springfield. What was his agenda here?
Well, so Kennedy was visiting Springfield as a part of a stop during a campaign tour. The midterms were in a month, and he was in Springfield to stump for Democratic candidates, namely Representative Sidney Yates. He was here to give a rousing speech to a crowd of thousands of people in Springfield, urging them to vote for his candidates.
So he comes to Springfield, and a motorcade ensues once he leaves the plane at the airport. And your newspaper at the time just had a brief blurb that something had occurred.
Well, I wouldn't even call it a blurb because it was two lines on page 7. It was part of, it wasn't even part of the main story. It was part of a story called Kennedy Sidelights that was explaining kind of the police presence it took to protect President Kennedy and to secure the motorcade. And the two lines didn't talk about how there was a rifle pointing at President Kennedy at one point in the motorcade. All it said was that two youths were arrested and that they were held for Secret Service. There was no follow-up and no explanation for why they were arrested. All we know about this incident so far is what was found in that biweekly report that was declassified 2 years ago. The report is about it's about 20 pages, but the brief about the motorcade is about a paragraph. And what it says is that there were two young men. They were in a second story floor of a building somewhere downtown. And as the motorcade passed by that building, once it left, an Illinois Department of Public Safety employee saw a rifle and a scope sticking out the window. And from there on, local police went and got the two youths, arrested them, and brought them to Secret Service. They were questioned by Secret Service. They admitted that they did stick the rifle out the window at the presidential motorcade, but their explanation for doing so was that they wanted to see if they can see the president through the scope of the rifle, so that when he came back through the motorcade 30 minutes later, they could see him better.
All right, thanks to Crystal Thomas from the State Journal Register down here in Springfield, Illinois, as well as NPR Illinois for the audio there. I'll include links to both in the comments for the show. Just over 1 year before, under a scenario that, I mean, you couldn't repeat it more, except they were in a second floor window instead of a sixth floor window. Exactly what happens in Dallas happened in Springfield, and no lessons were learned, because obviously, you know, Kennedy was staunchly opposed to riding in clothes of limousines for these, you know, he liked being with people, waving at the people, and didn't work out too well in Dallas, as of course Lee Harvey Oswald shoots three bullets and two of them find their target.
Yep. Well, that's so you say. So you say Lee Harvey Oswald. Yeah, I mean, look, Kennedy was not popular in the South. I
no.
think it's fair to say. Another multitude of reasons for it, but he didn't even want to go to Dallas. Kennedy, as people know now, didn't really know back then, was very ill, man. And his back was killing him. So I've got some sympathy as a fellow back sufferer there. But he goes to Dallas. There is this, you know, if you want to kill the president, here's where he's at. And then booked a point. We all know the story. We've all seen the movie. Everybody knows, you know, what happens then. Lee Harvey Oswald. Was it Lee Harvey Oswald who shot him? Yes, it was. Okay. Yeah. And I know I'm sorry to disappoint people. How can you say that, David? There's so much evidence. No, there isn't.
No,
so
there's
much
not.
Circumstantial stuff that builds up. And if you look at it in a funny way and squint from a different direction, you can see it was Lee Harvey Oswald. He did shoot him. Now, if you then want to come at me and say, did somebody put him up to it? Then I'll listen. If you then want to say, how did a guy who lived in the Soviet Union at the height of the... the height of the Cold War get allowed back into the US, that's a fair question. I'll listen to that. But did he shoot him? Yes, it was him. Immediately, this amazing story, you know, and to us it's just a story, Shane. You know, we weren't about, so we can't apologies to anyone who, you know, was maybe around at the time. But, you know, for us, we've only read about it or watched it or seen the footage. So the assassin gets shot in police custody 2 days later. Now, of course, that's going to start getting...
Yeah, we're going to raise some questions.
But the thing is that, you know, you were a journalist for years. You worked... the amount of times that incompetence is used as a... You know, people look at it and go, ha, it must be something. People are shit. People do stupid things and make errors and do daft things.
And I hate to break the cops like showing off when they've arrested someone, say the guy who shot the president.
They knew Jack Ruby. He was allowed to wander about the station. You know, it wasn't rare for Jack Ruby to be the cops. All knew him. He ran a nightclub. Again, his motivations. But I think the problem with any conspiracy theory is what people do is they start at the point they believe and then they work back. And you'll always be able to say, well, what about this? What about this? What about that? But it is intriguing and it definitely does ask a lot of questions that have kept going forever. LBJ, I'm sure you've read books as I have because there are a lot of them about how it was LBJ that was behind it. Personally, I think if LBJ wanted to kill Kennedy, he would just have stabbed him in the neck with a pen.
Yeah, he would have done himself.
Yeah, he'd have done it himself. You know, there's no doubt. And I think if LBJ had won Kennedy to kill, it would have been Bobby. I think if he had won assassination, you know, that he was allowed, I think it would have been Bobby that he... Well, maybe it was.
Maybe
but,
it was, yeah.
Maybe it was, yeah. But I think that, you know, sometimes we can do that. We can start off... It does look dodgy. It is interesting. It is... You know, something that you can speculate over endlessly, but it was Oswald who did this. Now, you then look at all the different factors: the Cold War, Cuba, Bay of Pigs, etc., CIA. And the problem that we have is that I personally know, because it's been 60 years, I don't think it'll ever be released to you. I don't think we'll ever get the... because surely after 60 years, you think you could be able to release this stuff.
Well, I mean, all the files from the House Select Committee had to wait 75 years from the date of the assassination. So I guess, yeah, I mean, we still technically have 18 more years to go.
Even then, I think they might find a way to block it. You know,
they always do. I mean,
yeah, I think, you know, that it might come out in like 100 years. I don't know, which again shows you the impact of it. But there are questions, you know, that are definite. Were there people who knew who Lee Harvey Oswald was? Probably. Right. Were there people who, you know, might have spoken to Lee Harvey Oswald? Probably. All of that is definitely a factor. So, but then I think you're moving away from who into why, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that's different. That is different.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, just on a personal, you know, I mean, I remember growing... It's something, especially growing up in my era, because it was so... overwhelmingly part of my parents, you know, that, I mean, World War III was going to start, right? I mean, somebody just murdered the president. We just got done with Cuba, and I mean, everybody was, they sent the kids home from school. I mean, it was going to happen. I remember finally going to Dallas, I don't know when this was now, 15 years ago, maybe. And it is strange, like the site of Garfield's assassination no longer exists. Obviously, you know, Lincoln's is a national monument. McKinley's, there's just like a rock there with a little plaque on it.
I feel so sorry for that. And he's only ever spoken of it as a footnote to Ted Roosevelt.
Dealey Plaza is one of the strangest places that you can ever go. Because, you know, I mean, you know what happened, and you know, you can see it, right? I mean, you set foot on the plaza, and the you know, opposite, the Zapruder film's in your head. I mean, you can see it. There's three X's on Oak Street marking where the three shots were. It's a very strange and surreal experience. And, you know, thankfully now, since he was the last one to be shot, it seems, well, shot and lived. shot and died, as the title of the show. You know, maybe we learned. I don't know. You know, I mean, the Reagan one was a weird one just because of how it went about. But, yeah, I don't know. I think there's still a very serious portion of the American psyche at large that is impacted just by the, I mean, the fact that you can watch your president be shot,
which would be the case
on television. Yeah.
If it was ever to happen again, it will be on, you know, it will be on the television. There will be a record of it. And yeah, no, it is. It's bizarre whenever you sit and you watch someone, when you watch a Zapruder film, you're watching a documentary. And one of the things that I always find strange is we've got watersheds, you know, we've got things that you can't show before 9 o'clock. So you couldn't show a fictionalized someone being shot and blood spurting from the neck, but in a documentary it's fine. And it's literally it's effectively a snuff movie when you think about it. You know, you're watching someone die. And I think, again, you know, all that he was and all that he represented, and in a way it's probably saved a lot of his, because a lot of stuff would have come out about Kennedy as he got older.
Yeah. All the stuff that has come out, but we can still romanticize him instead of...
But you know. That's exactly it. But he's still just this, you know, 46-year-old guy, handsome man, you know, as opposed to being an old, you know, rather creepy fellow. He does get romanticized, and he forever will be. He'll be held up. Whereas if you actually look at his presidential achievements, they're not huge. You know, they're not massively significant. But you've always, then you can always say, ah, but he would have. And you can't argue with that, can you? If someone comes away with that, you've nothing. It's the whole snatched promise thing from you that you know he was going to be that, and you can't argue with that because it's unprovable. But I think that you're right, it's had a resonance worldwide that will never go away, I don't think, that because there will always be, you know, we don't have footage of assassinations from the 15th century, you know, they are just things in books, whereas this will always be, and here you go, you can go and, you know, go and look at this. And it has a hold in the, to put it in context, there is a thread on the Rangers football fan website, followfollow.com, about the Kennedy assassination that has been there for around about 13 years now, right? Yeah. That still gets busy traffic on a football board in Scotland.
Yeah,
it's constantly being added to, and that's because that it captures people's imaginations in a way that I don't think anybody, you know, I can't think of many assassinations around the world that have had this impact, you know, worldwide. Apologies, because there'll be ones, you know, maybe in, you know, the East or whatever I'm coming at this from a Western culture point of view. That's where my bias is. But I can't think of any that's had that level of impact.
And I mean, there's also, I don't know, like a very modern financial capitalist framework that had been built out around the assassination of John Kennedy. You know, like, I mean, well, the gun Ruby used was sold at auction in 1991 for like $200,000. You know, people want to go see like the limousine, or they want to see the suit, or they, you know, it's just like, that's fucked up. And then obviously all the books and all the movies, of course, what's his dick's JFK, which completely fucked the heads of a whole new generation as far as the conspiracy theories go.
Yeah.
It's the one that's really buried, and, you know, and as you said, and I fully agree, and we'll repeat ad nauseum, the death of Lincoln is far, far more impact on the nation as a whole. But just how this one happened It'll never go away.
I don't think so. And I honestly don't believe that we will see all the papers in my lifetime. Ah. You know, never mind my dad. My dad was alive. He was a wee boy. I think he was 9 when it happened. You know, he thought that he might see it in his lifetime. I don't think we'll see it in mine. And yeah. I just, you know, that's the currency of it. That's the resonance of it. That still 60 years later, it would probably be deemed too politically explosive. Say there is a document out there that says, oh, you know, CIA did this or that, that they would still feel we cannot release that at this moment in time. Yeah. That, to me, is the biggest testament of what that led to. And again, you know, for him, he became a martyr. He became, as I say, the almost this sort of icon of snatched away promise, of doomed youth to a degree, which is... you know, clearly not the legacy he would have wanted, but it's going to ensure that he remains throughout history one of the most famous. And it's not automatic. We've just proved that. We just talked about two guys, you know, that history's barely remembers. So it's not, oh, he got shot and that's it. There was a lot more to it than that, you know, who he was, what he was. But I think Kennedy, to me, is less of a man than an emblem. You know, it's never really been about him. It's about what he was or could have been or what people wanted him to be.
We put out the call for questions, as with any crow pod, and of course 90% of them are about the Kennedy assassination, which I think we could have predicted.
This isn't the crow pod, it's a different one. Remember that. It's a spin-off, right? This is Benson to soap.
Okay, we'll take one. I picked one.
No, you can do a few. It's fine. Got time.
All right. Well, I don't know.
Your show, it's my network.
Let's start with it. Here you go. DJ wants to know, who really shot JFK? Lee Harvey Oswald.
Lee Harvey. Although, can I just say, one of the Onion's best headlines, you remember when John Kennedy Jr. died? One of the Onion's headline is, JFK Jr. dead, crazy WOP Giancana still hasn't forgotten.
Oh man, let's see. David Marshall of Heart and Hand, renown here. He wants to. Now I'm going to take all these context of the four situations that we've just talked about here. So he asks, what is the best way to be shot? And I would have to say how Garfield was shot, because he should have lived.
I'd rather get shot in the arm and it not...
Well, he got that too.
Yeah, but just the arm and it not to penetrate my skin.
like an airsoft gun kind of a thing, the little foam pellet.
Like a flesh wound. I've been shot with a Nerf gun and it hurts, so I wouldn't fancy. But it depends what you're after. I certainly... if I'm going to die anyway, then I'd rather just, you know, go without knowing it. I certainly wouldn't want the whole lingering 4-month death, no.
Yeah. Yeah, and once again, I cannot stress enough how bad this was. At one point, Bliss fisted him so bad, he ruptured his bladder. Like, they fucking killed him.
100% they did. He should have lived. And I'm not just saying that, you know, modern medical, he should have lived then.
Yeah. See, Stuart wants to know, which president are we most surprised was not shot?
Well, you know the one that people think we're going to do. So I'm not going to go with that. I think Nixon would have certainly expected somebody to
I mean, somebody tried to fly a plane into the White House. So.
Yeah, I think 68 to 72, you know, the height of the Vietnam crisis and whatnot, then I think that, you know, Nixon would have been one. That Johnson's another one, maybe.
Yeah. See, I'd go back to Jackson, I think, because there were a lot of people that really wanted to shoot him. Yeah. Sadly, he just beat the shit out of you before you even had the chance.
So. He would notice you coming, and even in his like 70s, would have just wandered over and beat the shit out of you with his cane. And also the fact that he was unkillable. See, you could have shot him, right? He fucking had bullets in him. People had shot him.
Yes.
He didn't let it bother him. You know, he just got on with it.
Uh, let's see. Last one here. Let's go with at Glitter Bomb. I don't know. Bandit. Whatever. Which president would you most like to have survived their assassination? I got to go Lincoln, because I think if Lincoln, isn't killed, we don't have Garfield and McKinley being killed, probably. And we have a drastically different world that we live in. I think a much more fairer and just world for a lot of people, at least certainly in my country. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I think if Lincoln had lived, we would feel it in our day.
Yeah.
You know, the legacy and the changes. I'm not entirely sure that's the case, even for Kennedy. You know, right. Had he lived, that we have a significantly different or better is probably the key word in that. Whereas I'm pretty sure if Lincoln had lived, he wouldn't have got everything right, but he would have got a hell of a lot more right than Andrew Johnson did. That I can say with confidence. So I think him particularly, and you know, in a darker way, that probably the one dying that had the most positive effect, which is horrible on the person I do, but would be McKinley, because then you get Roosevelt, and without Roosevelt you don't get this modern presidency. You don't get a lot of very positive legislation changes. If it hadn't been for Roosevelt, then by the kind of 1920s in America, the presidency could have been reduced to a ceremonial role.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely falling more into like just a head of state position as opposed to, the head of government. So
100%. It could have been like this, you know, almost constitutional monarch style role. You had a nice house and you opened, you opened monuments and things, but
and hopefully didn't get shot while you're
and hopefully didn't get shot. But you know, there would have been no point, and the leader of the speaker, or sorry, the house leader would have been what we consider the most powerful person in the country by now, and that process had begun.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. Well, and part of that was the fallout from Lincoln and Garfield being killed, obviously. You know. Because you keep losing presidents, you kind of go, maybe we shouldn't stick all the power in the government into this one guy. We did have one more. This one's actually good. The people who lived. Favorite attempt on a president who lives. Now, for mine, people really wanted to kill Gerald Ford.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. Well, and of course, I mean, it was Charles. Man, it was Squeaky Fromm who tried to kill him twice within about 2.5 weeks.
Gerald bloody Ford.
Yeah,
lovely. The Homer's pal.
Yeah.
I think that one was really awesome. I think that Reagan's reaction to it was just brilliant, and you know, I hope the doctor's a Republican and things like that. Just fantastic. Reagan's the weirdest one, because it had absolutely nothing to do with politics. No. You know, it could have been anybody in the president's chair. It was nothing to do with Republic. It was nothing to do with I want long term change. It was I have seen Taxi Driver and fancy the wee girl in it, which is incredible when you think about what that could have done to the world, you know, Cold War tension, all that kind of stuff, that the such a kind of silly reason and the impact that it could have had on the planet.
Yeah. Well, and I will point out the other very fucking random one. Well, because John Hinckley had actually tried to kill Carter, but Carter also had another assassination attempt by a man named Raymond Lee Harvey.
Why is it with three names, by the
way? All of them.
Whenever there's three names, John Wilkes Booth.
If you grow up going by three names,
drop one. Ooh. Yeah, you're a
don't
wrong
buy one. A firearm.
No, don't anybody that Lee Harvey or one name is sufficient, right?
Yeah. We're good.
Yeah.
All right, so yeah, that'll wrap it for the first Cropod history extravaganza here on Heart and Hand. Quick note, as we've talked about on Twitter and Facebook and everything else, I have a Interstate 55 road sign that is like the real big ass piece of steel that a friend of mine is giving me for us to auction off for the Rangers Youth Development Company. So it's $5 per entry. You go to paypal.me and then put in my Twitter handle is upvoid, O-F-V-O-I-D. It's $5 for entry. And the response, I was thinking about drawing it next week. The response has been pretty good. I might push it back one more week as long as people aren't going to flip their shit that I said it would be February 2nd. I think the more money we can raise for Colin Stewart and them over there is the better.
So. I think they'll agree with that. Yeah. Rangers Youth Development will benefit from it. So, no, I agree with that. And I think the listeners will as well.
No, so, hopefully, like I said, my friend, he's going to drop it off. I'm hoping here later this week. So we'll get a video or a picture up of it and whatever. And like I said on Twitter, I'm just going to buy him like a gift card to a restaurant for the effort. And we will donate all the money to the youth development company. So so far we're right around $200, give or take. And that's well really done. Just with me throwing it up on, what was that, Saturday?
We haven't even done a GoPod yet.
No. So yeah, hopefully between that tomorrow, but go take a look. You can find it on my Twitter page or the Crow's old Facebook page. I know David shared it all around and follow.
It's on our Facebook page as well. So yeah. There's plenty of places to find it.
So there we go. Me and David will be back Tuesday with your regular Crow Pod with Todd Van Allen. And that's it. So David, thank you. This was fun.
It was a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to talking about hearing some of the other ones. Yeah, you know, but we did it respectfully, mostly.
Yeah, God, man, Dr. Bliss. I tell you what.
Keep him the fuck away from me.
All right, folks, that'll do it. We'll talk to y'all soon. Bye.
People keep talking about me, baby.